pretty much burn my mouth with the sting of eating too much pineapple pretty much every summer. Haven't learned how to avoid that one yet. Besides, you know, preserving some of them for later eating and not being such a piggy, I guess. But what's cool about buying a pineapple is you not only get this delicious source of food, but you get a plant out of it as well. Most of the time, the farmers leave the tops intact. So not considered the best way to plant pineapples, but certainly a way to plant pineapples. And my patch started with tops, and I have slowly moved up into being able to harvest suckers or keikis from my adult plants for replanting. But when you
question to you, so when you plant from a top, you get a plant that does not yield as quickly?
Correct.
And does it affect the vigor of the plant over its entire life, or it's just slower to start?
In my experience, no. I think it's just slower to start, and because you have to get them to root out nicely, whereas if you get suckers off of the mommy plants, often they'll fruit sooner, even a whole year sooner. So that's the difference. It's about 2 years from a top and about 1 year from what is known as a slip. But the fruit is indigenous to Paraguay. Now, that's like a long way away. It's a tiny little country. It's pretty amazing how it found its way across pretty much the entire planet. Certainly a testament to its deliciousness. At 5 to 8 feet tall, can you believe it, that there's pineapple varieties that will grow a plant that's up to 8 feet tall? That's pretty incredible to me, with a 3 to 4 foot spread on width. And technically, pineapple is not a single fruit. It is called a compound fruit or a composite fruit. So each section or eye represents a separate fruit that are all fused together. And we look at other fruits such as breadfruit or jackfruit. Is that in the same family? Is that also a composite, Paul?
I'm not sure about that.
But breadfruit is, for sure.
Berries are often...
berries.
Raspberries, strawberries. I think those are compound fruits
mm-hmm.
as well. And I know that noni is.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, and they have a center core, and all of these little fruitlets are fused together around this core, usually an inedible core.
And we often think of the orchid, the vanilla orchid, as the only orchid, even though there's 26,000 species of orchids. It's the only one I know that actually yields something that's edible. Is the pineapple the only edible bromeliad, or can
that's a very good question. I'm not sure. I think it may be. That's a very interesting question.
It doesn't leave you wanting for another one.
Certainly not, when you sink your teeth into how delicious they are. And, you know, nutritionally speaking, vitamin A, vitamin C, good B-complex vitamins, but probably the most notable and unique molecule and phytonutrient inside of the pineapple is bromelain.
Yeah.
It's anti-inflammatory. It helps digestion. It has effect against intestinal worms and parasites. Good for the voice and for singing and the throat. Bromelain has some heart medicine, I believe. They're starting to discover more and more good uses for bromelain. So here's a really natural way to get it in its natural state, surrounded by all of its natural enzymes, which no doubt help your body absorb it. And just to help you, give you some tips on how to pick a good pineapple when you're at the market, certainly size matters. They're huge, enormous ones. If you don't feel like you'll go through that, they don't, they suffer, what is it called, cold burn. They don't refrigerate well. So you want to get a pineapple, ripen it on your countertop, and then be able to process it, as in cut off the rind and cut the core out, save your plant that you get with it as a free bonus from the top. And either refrigerate it after slicing it up or freezing it for later use. Certainly, I've had some delicious pineapple ice cream that was made just out of pure frozen pineapple in a Champion juicer. Really good. But when you're checking out pineapples at the market, chances are they've been picked, you know, a little bit early. They will ripen. what you're looking for is a real beautiful, fragrant perfume coming out of the stem end, the bottom of the pineapple.
The butt end.
The butt end, exactly. And, yeah, butts don't usually smell that good. But the pineapple will emit this beautiful perfume. I think if anyone out there listening has smelled it, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And...
maybe that's what dogs are experiencing when they smell each other's butt. It's like this delicious perfume.
Perhaps. Perhaps. So, yeah, ripening it to perfection usually means a nice golden yellow color. Although I'll say to folks, don't over-ripen them. What happens in the eyes sometimes with these natural organically grown ones, the ones I've picked out of my yard for sure, little mold will form inside those little eyes, mm-hmm. and they're quite hard to cut off. And so you end up having to cut off more of your meat of your pineapple than you'd like to just to get those eyes out of there. And another reason not to let the rind get any mold or bad spots on it before you cut it is that you can actually brew a really delicious tea. A friend of mine learned this in the Caribbean using the rind and the core of the pineapple in water and boiling it down for a little while with cinnamon sticks and star anise. And it makes just a really delightful summertime iced tea drink from a product that ultimately was just destined to feed your compost pile. So, I think that that's a nice little recipe, but fresh eating, they go great in stir fries. It's an excellent addition to any meat dishes, kebabs. These all go really well
Hawaiian
together.
Hawaiian pizza.
Hawaiian pizza, yes, absolutely. And, of course, you know, smoothies and ice pops and all those kinds of yummy things are good ways to use the bounty of pineapples that are happening right now. I like to stock up, fill my freezer, because you're basically not really going to see fresh pineapples that are grown naturally, as in not forced with hormones into fruiting at off times a year right now. Now is the time.
Okay, you've talked me into it. And some of our listeners, too, I'm sure. This is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio, and we're really excited to jump into our feature presentation because the hour is always going by way too fast. We are joined in studio by our dear friend, Tammy Davis. Tammy's the Residence Project Foundation's permaculture land manager and volunteer program coordinator at its 13-acre historic estate in Kilauea. She's been a student and teacher of permaculture since 1996. Tammy's love of mushrooms, which is our focus of the show today, steadily grew as she participated in the Telluride Mushroom Festival for 16 years in a row, holy cow,
Ooh.
And has been mentored by mushroom superstars including Paul Stamets, Gary Linkoff, and Andrew Weil. And Tammy, it's super great to have you with us.
All right. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. It's really fun watching you guys work as a team.
Thank you. Wait until you see us dig a hole.
Oh, great.
We're good at that, too. So, so we are focusing our show today on the wonderful kingdom of fungi, as you so eloquently put it. And why don't you just start off by letting us know a bit more about your amazing relationship, your personal relationship with mushrooms?
Yeah, I definitely love, anyone who knows me knows that I love mushrooms, and I've been fascinated by them since college. And I would say learned about plants when I couldn't find any mushrooms. Literally, I was looking around for mushrooms. Ah, there's not any here. What else is here? Oh, it's green. Well, okay, what does it look like? So it led me to other passions and lots of expanding opportunities to see what in nature, you know, is going on. It's amazing what the fungi are doing. And the more I learn, the more I'm convinced they're pretty much responsible for our life here.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Well, this conversation is kind of rounding out our whole month that we've discussed pest and disease management, correct? And we thought this was a very nice way to round out that discussion because there are so many ways that problems in our gardens are happening because of environmental toxins to begin with. And so coming back around to the soil and keeping it clean and using mycotechnology to make sure that we have clean space to work with in the first place is definitely a step towards having a disease and pest-free, bountiful garden.
Yeah. Yeah, and I believe that the mushrooms are a keystone species, as Paul Stamets has taught a lot of us. all the lignans and all that woody plant material would never break down if it wasn't for the fungi. I mean, we'd be stuck with the same trees that fell over hundreds of years ago. And you see that in the desert where there's not enough moisture for very much fungal growth. A lot of things just sit and don't break down. And they just are really, really good at making nutrients available for the rest of life. And so they're sort of like the first, one of the first hitters when you're trying to recycle any kind of materials on the planet.
Right. And as we know, mushrooms, there's always examples in nature where the opposite is true. It's one of the permaculture sort of principles. And it, so is it true that there are mushrooms that do thrive in arid environments?
Yeah, if there's just even a littlest bit of moisture. I was walking down a trail in Canyonlands in Utah and Moab, and somebody's footprint must have left some spores, and it was just a brief rainstorm. And, like, within 24 hours, there was a mushroom sprouting out of red, dry sand.
Wow.
So they'll take advantage of any bit of moisture. They do need water to make their bodies grow. But they can survive extreme climates in the spore form. So they can go into outer space and back. They can do all kinds of amazing things. And then when the conditions are right, they start putting out little hyphae, like little string-like forms, and then turn into a whole net and start catching nutrients and transforming and eventually bunch up and form a fruiting body. And that's what we recognize as a mushroom. But if you pick a mushroom, you're not really killing the organism, because the mycelium is really the part that lives continuously in the soil or on the wood or whatever it's living on.
It's just like picking a fruit off a vine.
Exactly, yeah.
Sure, and, you know, there's certain environmental conditions to promote fruiting that happen either by nature or if we're trying to cultivate these at home, that seems to me to be the clincher of you can get a lot of mycelium growing, but can you make the conditions just so that the mushroom feels like fruiting?
Yeah, I've found that if you actually starve them a little bit and dry them up a little bit and they start thinking, maybe I'm not going to make it, then you water them, and the temperature and humidity are the key factors. Also, sometimes destructive kind of impacts can make them want to fruit. So lightning strikes used to yield mushrooms, and the Japanese observed that, and so they started whacking their fruiting logs to get them to fruit. They'd whack them with a baseball bat or some kind of stick.
Sure.
And that helps too. So any kind of, they tend to thrive in catastrophes as well. So they do a lot of amazing things.
Oh, well, they're probably doing really, really well then in our world as it stands.
Mushrooms, people love to talk about them. There's a lot of talk about mushrooms, and that's why we're, and when it comes to actually growing them, a lot of the talk is kind of theoretical. And so that's one of the reasons it's great to have you in studio, because you don't just talk about how great mushrooms are, you actually are growing them. And as somebody who only grows mushrooms because you can't stop mushrooms from growing, so I suppose I'm a mushroom grower too, anytime I chop down a tree or whatever, but I'm not doing it consciously. I'm not selecting mushrooms that are edible or medicinal or have other qualities. And so you are doing that, and so we want to squeeze that knowledge out of you. And how do I get started? If I'm a green thumb gardener, is it a pretty easy transition over to also cultivating mushrooms, or is it kind of a different way of thinking about things?
It's a little different, but it's also in line with some of the debris that we create in our everyday lives. So the easiest track is to grow oyster mushrooms, Pleurotus ostreatus. They are already on the island. Some are naturalized. Some you can bring in. There's pink ones, yellow ones, gray ones, white ones. And they're all easier to grow than most of the other cultivated species. They like to grow on coffee grounds. And coffee grounds are already previously pasteurized when you make your coffee. And so if you just get it fresh out of the coffee pot, dump it into a bucket with holes so there's nice drainage, and add some spawn or some kind of, you have to get a hold of some oyster mushroom mycelium. But it's really easy because you can either clone a wild one that you find or find a friend who has some. I would love to share the mycelium I have. And you just start adding the mycelium clumps into your fresh coffee grounds and let it sit. And after you get about a gallon's worth of medium, that's a nice size to like leave it alone and let it do its thing. It'll colonize the whole thing completely, turn very white, and you keep it dry, like a dried out sponge is the nice moisture content. You don't have to water it because there's so much moisture in the coffee grounds. As long as you let it drain, it'll just chase the moisture as it spreads through the coffee grounds. And then I like to dry it out a little bit and then put a little humidity tent, like throw something or put it and keep it in a dark corner and then give it a little more moisture. And that's when they like to fruit. So usually 2 weeks to colonize, another couple weeks it might fruit.
Wow.
Might fruit two or three times. Then you want to put that compost, which is really, really nutritious, good compost it leaves behind, into your garden.
Mm-hmm. So when I was reading about growing mushrooms at home, overall, most of the web resources said, just buy a kit mm-hmm. for getting started. You know, that's the best way to get started. But I do know there are some regulations in Hawaii about what mycelium is allowed to arrive here. And I imagine you have some experience with that, having done it. So how do you get the strains, particular strains that you might be interested in?
Yeah, I started finding that I wanted to order from, I usually order from Fungi Perfecti, which is a company that Paul Stamets started, and I've been ordering them for them for like 20 years. And when I went to go order some after living here, it was like, oh, you have to have some paperwork. So I contacted, I looked it up on the web and I don't remember, but it's a government agency and they regulate. But certain species, it's free. You can actually get them. You don't have to pay any permit fees. You just have to tell them what you're getting and what you're going to do with it. And then you send that paperwork into Fungi Perfecti and they'll ship to you. Now, that's good for oyster mushrooms. And there's a couple other ones that I think are unregulated. They're already here. They don't want you to bring in certain things like maybe reishi and other things. They don't want it to naturalize, or maybe there's an industry they're protecting. I'm not exactly sure why. Mm. But certain ones that would probably grow really well here are regulated. So you have to just ask the government agency. I think it's through the
It could be the Department of Agriculture,
yeah.
I would guess. They usually are the people who screen.
And so I just had to write a letter, fill out a form, and I got a response. I sent that to Fungi Perfecti, and then they mailed me. Now, the other mushroom that I'm working with is called Strepharia rugosa annulata, and that's something that is only allowed to be grown in like a greenhouse or kind of a more maintained environment, not just out in the wild. But it's, you can bring it in, and I think I paid a fee, but I also, no, here's it. You're limited to how many bags you can bring in per year. So you can start, luckily you can take a bag of spawn, and if you know the tricks, which I could teach easily, you can expand that 100 times within the year. So once you start with one bag of spawn, you can definitely multiply it out quite a bit, and it grows prolifically. I think it likes different substrates. Some of the things I think would be really great on this island to be collecting and using for substrate are coconut husk fibers. I save all my old coconuts. If you dry them out and if you could shred them, it'd be ideal. But even in the coconut pile itself, I have mushrooms fruiting just right out of the coconut husk. And then the coffee grounds are another thing. They can handle mac nut shells, straw. I'm going to be starting to grow them on canaf, which we have somebody locally who's trying to generate a larger canaf growing industry. And so the ground up canaf did really well with the oyster mushrooms and the Strepharia rugosa. Those Strepharia rugosa are also called garden giants. They're edible. Wine cap is another name for it. It's got a burgundy cap. Really big, meaty mushroom, can grow pretty big stature. Mm. And so those are things that once you learn how to keep the mycelium running, which is the name of Paul Stamets' book, by the way, Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World.
What a fantastic book.
I've
read it cover to cover.
It's really the only one written like it, and we bugged him for 5-10 years to write it because he kept talking about it, and we were like, can you just write all this down for us?
Sure. Now, I'm certain that cultivating mushrooms up in his part of the world and where you've lived as well varies a bit from our Hawaiian culture, mainly because we don't get the chill down here.
Yeah.
That there's got to be so much competing fungus going on that would very easily take over, even I would imagine if you had a fairly strong spawn or seed culture going.
Yeah, one thing that you have to learn how to do is introduce a lab spawn, which is grown in a sterile environment, into the atmosphere kind of slowly, so it learns to produce the enzymes to kind of tolerate the whatever's out there.
Mm-hmm.
So they do run into a little competition, but also cooperation. They sort of take over a certain niche and then let other things take over other niches. And so you want them to be introduced into the wild, like keep them protected and strong growing, and then you kind of introduce a little bit more and more contamination until they can hold their own outside. And so, you know, that's why you take the lab spawn and you start spreading it into pasteurized material medium.
Okay,
and then
so you do some
pre-pasteurize. Well, the coffee grounds, and then I take a big 55-gallon drum, fill it with a third of water, and steam things. So if I'm steaming a substrate, that way it gives the mushrooms a little two-week head start on all the other bacteria, molds, and other types of fungi. But in the tropics, for sure, you have to chase it pretty fast. If you cut down a tree, it's likely already got mushroom mycelium in it, because the primary decomposers are often just like right there ready to pounce as soon as anything even shows any disease or anything. It's weak.
That was what I was going to ask, because I had seen you in years before in the Fungi Perfecti catalog those dowels.
Yeah.
Those wooden dowels that are already impregnated with the spawn, and the instruction was to drill holes in a new log and just hammer them in.
Yeah.
And that seems like the easiest thing, but that wouldn't work so well here?
If you got a very fresh log, like literally within moments of cutting it down, usually they say you want to dry the logs out and let them sit around for a few months. But in this case, I would say guava is a really good potential substrate, either chipped or using any kind of size logs. Guava wood, and usually in the mainland we use soft hardwoods. So something that's kind of a weedy nuisance and you want to get rid of, and you can chip or cut it into sections. And then you want to drill the holes and plug them and cover them up with wax or something so nothing else is getting in that same hole. I use beeswax usually.
Right away.
Yeah, right away.
Right away.
Just pack it in there right away.
You have to have a system with your spawn is ready, your logs, and I have a dream about log culture, probably from reading Paul Stamets' books and the shiitake logs.
Yeah.
I mean, God, they're just so beautiful. And having grown just a shiitake kit years ago, and the taste of a fresh, freshly harvested shiitake mushroom was so unlike anything I'd ever purchased in the store.
They're super good for your health. I mean, a lot of immune-boosting qualities these mushrooms have.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when you're doing this, I'm guessing just for your own use,
Educational purposes. I teach a lot of volunteers. Anyone who comes, I like to teach and share my knowledge of fungi. Just spread the word, because they're so helpful and beneficial with our environment, especially our challenges with toxins, as you guys will get into more.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we have a mushroom farm here on the island that's producing, you know, large scale, commercially available mushrooms. Yeah, it's in Lawai Valley.
Yeah.
But one of the pieces to me that take it from being a home use sort of hobby, sort of fun thing, or to, I do want to talk about how you're using it to clean up your little oil messes and stuff too, but unpredictable harvests can, you know, if you don't really have it down and you do get some competing fungus in there, and, you know, you have X amount of pounds sold if you're a commercial, you know, grower, and then suddenly your mushrooms don't come on the way you wanted, can make it difficult to be in business, you know.
Yeah, if you're doing purely mushrooms, you better have a lot of them and a lot of backup, because it does happen regularly, contamination or lack of fruiting, and it's tricky, and I wish that guy the best of luck, because it's so nice to have the freshly grown mushrooms in the store and available at the market.
Yes. Yeah, so you're doing it mainly right now for your own use, your own enjoyment.
For a little community. And then, you know, in general, sometimes I get a bunch of them and then I don't have any for a long time. So it is something, if you were a market gardener, you'd want to just have them on your table with other stuff that you're doing when you have them.
Right, so it is a good choice for small, diversified farms in that regard. Well, can you just maybe recommend a couple books or some reading that if people are more interested, or maybe even your contact information, so if people want to learn some more about cultivating, they can talk to you about it.
Sure. My email is ancientspin, ANCIENTSPIN, spinning around for a long time kind of thing, at hotmail.com. And if anyone would like to talk mushrooms, I would love to one day teach a workshop. We can talk about having a gathering at the food forest or somewhere, one of our amazing locations, and doing some cultivation techniques. I learned most of what I learned from Paul Stamets. And again, I mentioned his book already, Mycelium Running. And then there's another couple identification guides that I use. There's one called Mushrooms of Hawaii, and it's Don Hemmes, H-E-M-M-E-S. He's a PhD, and he wrote in 2002, we saw this book was a survey of the mushrooms on Hawaii.
A gorgeous book, that one.
Yeah, and then my favorite is All That Rain Promises and More, and it's more of a Western field guide, but it's a pocket hand, you know, book that you can just kind of generally quickly start to key your mushrooms out. And David Arora, he's my favorite mushroom guide for the West Coast, and this kind of, you know, some of those mushrooms show up here because people drag them back and forth in their soil and their feed and everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's true. I never really thought about how those mushroom spores can travel on our shoes, too.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they do. Well, I'd like to spin another guest into our conversation.
Please.
Right now. We're joined by Howard Sprouse. Howard is an environmental scientist and founder of The Remediators, commercializers of micro-remediation technology. Howard is internationally recognized for his contribution to micro-remediation, the use of fungi for cleaning contaminated soil and water, and is an authority on bioremediation technologies and biochar. He joins us via internet link from Washington State. Howard, are you with us? I sure hope we're going to be able to link you in here. We're trying to use our Skype connection. Howard, are you there? Great. I'm trying to patch you in to our board. Having a little difficulty. Try me again. Oh, that's not really working.
It was better when you unplugged that.
It sure was. We've got our station manager charging into the studio to make this work.
Yeah. When you take that out, it worked.
It sure did. Howard, try me one more time. All right. We're just going to play you straight out of my computer here. Howard. Shoots, now it seems like we've lost him altogether. Howard, are you with us? All right. Well, let's...
Yeah, I'm with you, Paul.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to ask you to speak up because it seems our connection is not working substantially well.
Okay. Well, how's that, Paul?
That's great. So, it's great to have you with us. We're really excited to hear about your groundbreaking work. I'm wondering if you could start off by telling us how you got into this pioneering work of using mushrooms for bioremediation.
Oh, I tell you, it's been a long journey. I came through it just as a lover of nature and a lover of mushrooms. I've always been interested in wild harvesting things ever since I was a small child, and I happened to land on the Olympic Peninsula about 42 years ago, and it's mushroom paradise here. And over the years, as my knowledge built with it, I eventually became useful to different organizations. I've done consulting work to the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, assisting them in...
Yes, so we're recognizing that this remediation...
We started our own dedicated remediation.
Oh, boy. I'm afraid we're having a little difficulty with our connection to you. How about you give us a try calling us on the studio line? If you can hear me, it's 808-826-7771, and we'll patch you in via phone.
Okay.
Okay, hey, thanks so much. It's 808-826-7771, and I apologize to everyone for the technical difficulties. We thought we were going to get Howard a little bit freer and clearer, but we'll get him patched in here pretty soon. So, and yet we continue to be joined in studio by Tammy Davis of the Resonance Project, and we were talking just before we started, and it sounded like maybe there's a possible mushroom workshop afoot, so we're trying to formulate that learning opportunity for people here on Kauai, because I know a lot of people would like to be growing their own fresh mushrooms for eating. And one of the mushrooms we haven't really talked about is the shiitake. Mm. Is that a more difficult mushroom to grow?
It takes a little bit longer. It's about a, for at least on the mainland, it's about a 2-year process. It probably could be shortened here because everything grows faster. But the shiitake, you inoculate a log. I've had it fruit anywhere from 2 to 4 years after I inoculated it. So it takes some planning ahead. And then you got to keep inoculating. And I know, I think that some of the, besides having edibles, some of the needs, like what he was about to address, are that we have some toxins to take care of. And I do think that some of the mushrooms that take up toxins actually don't concentrate any toxins in their bodies. So, for instance, you can use oyster mushrooms to clean up a diesel or an oil spill, and then yet the oyster mushroom itself doesn't have any of those toxins in it. It completely rips apart the hydrocarbons and distributes them as carbon dioxide and water and different more naturalized. And if you have any heavy metals, you have to worry about the mushroom uptaking. And so I'm sure that your guests will know a lot more about that. You just want to make sure that any mushroom that you're using for bioremediation, if there's any heavy metals involved, then that's something you wouldn't want to ingest. So, you know, some mushrooms that are good for bioremediation, actually you'd never even see them fruiting. They just, the mycelium itself does the work, and the fruiting body's not really notable. So there's a lot of different ways to use these things in different environments. But we have a great need to have them, even just in your ordinary household, any place that you're doing mechanic work or changing your oil or dripping any little machinery parts or anything like that. It's nice to have the oyster mushroom spawn growing either on straw or wood chips or even cardboard. Cardboard is a great medium for mushrooms. So you can just soak ordinary brown cardboard, and then the mycelium loves to run through the corrugated part. There's enough air and enough sugars in that cardboard. The mycelium just takes off. And that's one way I can clone really easily any mushroom that I find with a little bit of stem flesh. You just basically cut little thin strips and put it on the soaked cardboard, and it just turns back into mycelium and starts growing into whatever else.
Incredible.
Awesome. Well, I think we have Howard back on the line. Howard, are you with us?
I am. Hi, Paul.
Great.
Yay, excellent.
Thanks.
Oh, we're so excited to have our conversation with
yeah.
you, too.
Thank you for persevering with us. So,
well, you bet. You know, I guess this is just another testimony for natural technology.
Indeed, it is. So, again, to let folks know, we're speaking with Howard, who is doing bioremediation with mushrooms. But you said as well that when we were speaking earlier that it's one of a suite of different technologies that you're using in concert, and you were speaking about the importance of this was all before we were recording, that we had this discussion. You were telling me about how it's a very site-specific solutions, and every time you address a remediation cleanup, you're kind of starting from not scratch so much, but you're really inventing a novel solution for that particular situation.
Yeah, that's probably pretty well put, Paul. It's what we found over the years is that there's a lot of site variability. And so depending on the contaminant and where it is, we end up having to tailor a suite of different solutions. And so some of the variables can be things like, well, how much does it rain? Is it a place that's forested and there's a lot of humic materials and other organisms growing? Or is it sand? We've done some remediations in sand. And so when we look at a job, we look at the whole thing, and we look at it by characterizing it, finding out what the contaminant is and what the basic ecology of the site is. And then once we have an idea about that, we'll tailor our cleanup to fit the actual site. So, you know, a lot of people ask us, well, what's the silver bullet? Is there a silver bullet, a certain kind of mushroom that that we use? And the short answer is no. And in fact, I've tried to stay away from using fungi that normally is found in medicinal and culinary use, and trying to stay away from fungi that fruits. Our goal is not to use mushrooms that make fruit bodies, but rather to use fungi and allow them to clean up the contaminant.
Yeah, particularly, you know, I was really interested in, because a lot of times when we think of, you know, the need for remediation, we might think of large, you know, catastrophes or big deals. But I was really interested to read about your green light soil check, which is just kind of lays down some of the pretty nasty contaminants that people can find just in a property or a piece of land or a place they just bought and maybe want to do some homesteading or growing of food. And the list of things that are found typically in backyards was pretty extensive. I mean, besides diesel, gas, and oil, solvents, paints, even household cleaners, and then some of your heavy metals. And, of course, if the place was used agriculturally in a not very conscious way, you could find things like pesticides and insecticides as well. So it was nice to know that you can do this on just a small scale, too, just within your little one-acre home site.
Oh, yeah. And you know that most of the home sites that we've dealt with, it's been old heating oil tanks. And so that's pretty simple. Hydrocarbons are real easy. It's when you start getting these suites of compounds, like some of the other ones that you mentioned, that it becomes more difficult. And so the evolution of the technology, I guess you would say, is that, you can do this yourself. You can do it at home with some limitations. And that is part of what gave us the incentive to look at more than simply using fungi when we look at doing a particular cleanup. And I can give you an example, we did a small industrial site they collected waste oil from a large trucking facility. And so, anyway, a lot of this stuff got spilled into the soil. And so you have a combination of metals and hydrocarbons. And so fungi is really, really good at breaking carbon-hydrogen bonds. It's really good at going after oil. But it's not as good at going after metals. And so in a situation like that, we look at whether we want to, maybe use some plants along with it, use phytoremediation to enhance that, to actually draw the metals up out of the soil. Or in certain cases, you can sequester them by using other earth minerals and clays and different types of things depending on the soil. And so I think that if I were going to advise somebody to toward looking at micro-remediation as a way of doing some transitional agriculture, for instance, I think that the first thing you do is you figure out what you've got. And then when you know what you have, then you decide how large of a suite of different sorts of treatments you would need to do to get to where you want to go.
Yes, and the process of finding out what you have can be kind of expensive. Those laboratory tests are not cheap.
Well, it is, and in fact, the incentive that we used on this green light soil check was that when properties change hands, as a part of that process, you need to know what you're selling and what you're buying, and so that is as much an assessment as it is a path toward cleaning something up. Mm-hmm. And so, I looked at the video that you sent me of the projects that you're looking at in Hawaii of dealing with some of the contaminants related to past agricultural efforts there. And I think that's a real good candidate for micro-remediation. And yet I also think that because you're talking about properties that, agriculture is industrial in nature. You're talking about really looking at a careful characterization and then designing your system that you want to use to do that.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. This is Tammy. I was curious what your solutions are for some of the wastewater cleanup, because we do have some reefs that are in danger here. We have rivers that are contaminated. There's a lot of agriculture and probably human waste getting mixed in and sent downstream. As well as silt. And so I was looking at the Staphylococcus rugosa annulata as something that could be a microfiltration. What is your solution for the runoff and the water treatment?
Oh, that's a real good question. Of course, the best solution is to not allow any of the stuff to get put into the runoff, into the watershed. But in lieu of that, if you can deal with it, the closer you can deal with it to its source, the better. And in a natural solution to handling stormwater is something that it's kind of flow dependent. And in Hawaii, you share some similarities with us here in Washington State. Like, for instance, I'm in Western Washington, And if you go out to the west side of the Olympic Peninsula where we live, the town of Forks, they get 90 inches a year of rainfall. And in the slopes of the Olympic Mountains, it's close to some of the rainfall that you see on the west side of the island. And so in a situation like that, we have focused on setting up their size-dependent systems that are able to handle a maximum or an average flow that goes through there. And so, for instance, all problems that we have around here, a lot of it relates to tannins in the water from logging operations or nutrients from agricultural runoff. And in a situation like that, you can set up a bed, essentially, and use a combination of fungi growing in there. I started doing research on biochar a number of years ago, and that's one of the suite of tools that we have in our tool chest that we use. But we design these systems so that they're able to handle just as much of the runoff as they have to during stormwater events. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, it's definitely something that I think we have to look at the runoff and the situation, how much water's flowing through there, and how do you keep all the filtration in place and all that. So I'm just curious to study more and share what I know.
Yeah, and you know what? That if there ever were a time in the history of the world, and especially of this country, that bioremediation is making its way, it's right now. That as we look at low-impact development, we look now that there's a lot of opportunity for us to set systems up that are self-managing. And that's pretty much what you're trying to achieve when you're looking at biological solutions to runoff management and contamination issues. And so the state of Washington has really been a leader in developing low-impact development solutions. And it's a really good check out the Washington State Department of Ecology, some of the work we've been doing down here using natural solutions. It's really groundbreaking and totally adaptable to your part of the world.
Awesome. So we're excited about your work. Whenever we hear about work that's being done by people on the national, the global scale, and we don't quite have it here in Hawaii, we're always thinking about how can we get this kind of technology? How can we get a company like yours or your company or something happening? Because we do recognize all of the remediation that does need to happen. Of course, we want to work with the natural systems like mushrooms, like biochar. What would you recommend to us so we can spur this work forward, which might be the combination of getting a company that, you know, is geared up and has the expertise to do it, and then also how do we move some of these some of the companies that are maybe being the source of the pollution to do the right thing and start cleaning up after the activities that they're doing?
Yeah, I don't think those are really mutually exclusive issues. What we've been challenged to over the past several years to do is to do more education. And in fact, the remediators we've started to develop. We're developing a training program to help people learn how to do this. And we're also working internationally. I get calls they come in clumps. Some months I'll get three or four calls. Some weeks I'll get a call from Europe. And so what we're trying to do is to network with people to move these technologies forward and get them into broader use. And so, like right now, I have a company in France that we're sharing information with. One of the things that we have done in the remediators is we developed a system of challenging different types of fungi and matching them to different types of pollutants. And so I think that there's something that really distinguishes the approach that we're trying to teach people how to use. That's it, because it's not one size fits all. We found that, for instance, one of the, I do a lot of collecting of fungal strains from areas where forestry operations have happened. There's a lot of sawdust here now because of the mechanized way that they harvest timber. And so we'll collect fungi, all of the same species and genus, in one area that's been harvested, timber's been harvested, and they show different properties in the laboratory as we trial them against fungi. Well, this is the type of thing that we're trying to train people how to do. We'd be happy to help you over there with that.
Thank you so much. We happily accept. We look forward to continuing the conversation with you. Sadly, we've run out of time on our show today.
Yeah.
But, Howard, thank you so much for joining us, and keep up the good work and keep inspiring us to help make the change with you.
Yeah, you bet. It's been nice meeting you, Paul, and look forward to seeing you later sometime.
Fantastic. Thank you, Howard. We'll be in touch soon.
Mahalo nui.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Well, this has been In the Garden on the Farm. On Kauai Community Radio, we want to thank so much our special guests on the show today. Tammy Davis of the Residence Project is sitting right with us right now. Tammy, thanks so much for taking the time and sharing your passion of mushrooms, and looking forward to having hands-on experience with you. Coming up, if you want to be in touch with Tammy, her email is ancientspin@hotmail.com. We also want to thank Howard Sprouse, and he's one of the owners and operators of The Remediators Incorporated. You can find their information at theremediators.com. Just want to let people know about talk tonight, our Right to Health, Environmental and Food Safety, focusing on research on glyphosate as a probable carcinogen. Dr. Stephanie Seneff and Dr. Judy Carman. This is going to happen tonight in Princeville at 7 p.m. at the Church of the Pacific, and tomorrow, Thursday, at 7 p.m. at the Kauai Community College Performing Arts Center. So check that out if you choose to do so. And brought to us by GMO-Free Kauai. Please stay tuned for Kauai Vibrations with Tracy and all the other great programming. And Robin, thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. We hope we've inspired you.
And tune again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.